is Happiness Solved with Sandy Scarlatta. Stay tuned for my interview with Michael Alden. Welcome to Happiness Solved. I am really looking forward to today's interview with Michael Alden. He has been a best-selling author multiple times. He has been on dozens of networks promoting products with his infomercials. And you can learn more about his books and the products that he promotes on michaelalden.net. Hey, Michael, how are you today?
Fabulous. It's early, though. I'll get better.
It's early.
You know, I say that all the time. I learned that from Zig Ziglar. He taught me that. And I had the opportunity to do some things with him. I did an infomercial for him back in the day. I went to the 59th anniversary of his 21st birthday. And that's he taught me that. So it freaks people out, you know, especially people that you don't know. You're at the drive-thru and they say, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm fabulous, but I'll get better." Well, what's better than fabulous? I don't know, but I'm just trying to get there.
Now, I saw on your website that you've done a lot of infomercials.
Yes.
Like, what kind of infomercials have you done? That's pretty cool.
So I've been on TV for the past 10 years, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all over the world as the host. We have a bunch. It's an interview style format where I call it like the Larry King type set or Charlie Rose type set, where it's just me and a guest. So we've had a couple that have been on for a long time. One is a product called Arthra-D, which is a joint health supplement. Another one called Androzine, which is it's a male sexual health product. It's, you know, it's put in the category of, quote, male enhancement, but it's more done in a clinical sense. And it's rare to see that type of product on TV for that long. And then we've done a bunch for books and pet products, and we had one for cryptocurrency. So we do a lot of different ones, but the longest running ones we've had is the joint health one, and then the male sexual health one called Androzine.
Neat. That's so cool. So I may have seen some of your infomercials. I usually end up falling asleep on our couch watching TV, and I wake up in the middle of the night and I'll just sit there and I'll be like mesmerized. And I'm one of those people who immediately grabs her phone and I order everything. And then it shows up and I'm like, when did I order this?
What happened? Yeah, you know, it's funny. And you think of an infomercial, I mean, the world is changing certainly, but you think of an infomercial, yeah, as those late night things. But, you know, that's, you know, they're different now. But, you know, a few years ago, it was, you know, it wasn't just that night. It was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. At night, it's cheaper at night to buy the time, basically. So if you wanted to buy like a 1 o'clock spot, like, you know, if you're here in Boston, you know, on like the local, you know, NBC affiliate at 1 o'clock, like before or after a football game, that's expensive. But you could buy that same on that same station at 3 a.m. for, you know, like, you know, 1/10 of the price. So that's why a lot of times people would see infomercials late at night. And also, if you go back to the history of infomercials, late at night, there was no time slots, right? So infomercials just started airing there because that was the only time that was available.
Right. So you're in Boston.
Can you tell?
Yeah, I'm reading your hat, Wicked Happy.
Yeah.
I don't hear the Boston accent.
Yeah, you know, it comes out once in a while. Yeah.
Is it one of those things after a couple of beers, it comes out more and more?
Yeah, I used to. Yeah, I used to say, like, I used to be fluent in Spanish, too. And they used to come when I drank is when it would come out. But I you know what? We talk about happiness, right? So it's talking about, like, I haven't drank in a year.
Oh, good for you.
I'm not like, I was never like a heavy drinker or anything like that. I'm going to be 46 this year. And I just found that they actually had a real negative impact on my overall happiness and recovery. And I just couldn't recover anymore. Like, you know, when I say recover, like you drink and, you know, it takes 2-3 days to feel normal again. So
yeah,
said, you know what? My happiness is actually too important. I call it hangxiety, right? So the next day you have that, you know, you're hungover and God forbid if it's during the week or see, my businesses are 24/7, like literally 7 days a week. So if you had to deal with something that next day and you're already hungover and you already feel, you know, we know alcohol is a depressant. So you're just not feeling good in general. And then you have to deal with like, you know, putting out fires as an entrepreneur, which is constant. It just wasn't productive. So yeah, it's been a year and I don't know that I'll ever drink again. I don't know. I just have no weird. I'm like, it's not really weird. I just, again, I was never like a big drinker, but when I did drink half Irish, it's all or nothing for me.
Yeah. Hey, you know, whatever works. That's the only important thing. Yes. Happiness. This is about happiness. And I was reading some of your bio and you sounded like you have a really interesting life, but I want to hear it from you. So tell the listeners about your your upbringing and some of your experiences and how you've gotten to this place.
Yeah, you know, I always start with, you know, this kind of monologue, if you want to call it that, where, you know, my first book, Ask More, Get More, I the first line I say is I say, thank God I was born poor. And it kind of really kind of draws people in with that first line. But yeah, I grew up tough, man, like really tough. You know, my mom's HIV positive. My stepfather died of AIDS. My mom always says, Mike, I have a problem with you telling people that. But just, let me just clarify for my mom, like she wasn't a drug addict. My stepfather was and infected her. And my father was addicted to coke. My stepmother recently died of an overdose. Another brother of mine did time for distribution. Another one died of an overdose. Kid I grew up with in jail for life of murder. And I was just surrounded by just crime, drugs, violence, negative things, you know, difficult, you know, financially. I was a kid that stood in the separate line in elementary school, middle school, and high school because my lunch was subsidized by the state. Salvation Army, you know, subsidized our dinners. I was just telling someone the story. And I completely like, kind of blocked this part out too. You know, look, there are a lot worse situations than mine. And when I think about like places like Compton or Watts or South Central LA or like South Side of Chicago, where kids are being shot at. And I forgot, when I was 14 years old, we were just talking about this, I was actually shot at point blank range, like within like 6 feet from each other. And I thought about it and I was like, holy shit. Like,
that's,
I don't know,
crazy.
32 years ago. And It literally just yesterday, just quickly, because I don't talk about it that much because I just kind of forgot about it. And so that was my upbringing and it was tough. And when we talk about happiness, it's really hard to find that. But as a kid, right, when you look at kids, no matter where they grow up, there's a point where it changes. But for the most part, unless there's a real chemical imbalance, kids are just happy. Yep. You know, like we're just happy with playing in the dirt and happy just, you know, with an ice cream and all these little things. And then something just shifts with our life. So growing up was difficult, but I wouldn't have wanted it any other way because it also, you know, made me the person I am. But when I say all that stuff, just to be clear, like I actually had a pretty happy childhood. It was just tough.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, you know, kids generally, especially when they're born and toddlers and, you know, you get to 5 and 6 and then the world gets to you.
Yeah.
And things start to shift. You know, everybody's born as an innocent baby, like you said, unless you've got some sort of chemical imbalance, because that would be a caveat there. But it's, yeah. So was that the motivating factor to write all your books and create your company? And
yeah, you know, I you know, what happened was is all that stuff I told you about. You know, and I have other, you know, friends that are still around. And, you know, again, you heard like my brother and my father and my stepmother and all this stuff. And I started writing things down. And so people would always say to me, Mike, what makes you so different? Like, why are you different? Same household, you know, same parents, essentially. You know, my parents were divorced, so I had a stepmother, but my dad was always around. He was, you know, always there. Like, why, you know, you, like, you know, and that was actually the working title for my first book, like, what makes you so different? And then it ended up becoming Ask More, Get More. And what I kind of realized was, is there were, you know, there were definitely some people in my life, coaches and teachers. My parents were always there. Like, when I say my father was addicted to coke, you know, he was, and but he wasn't like a hardcore drug addict. He was addicted, went to rehab, came out, and then never looked back. But he's also, you know, he smokes pot into this days in his 70s, and, you know, he's been smoking pot his whole life. And so, like, I was going down the wrong path too. You know, it was by the grace of God, go I, they say. And I remember at a very young age, my parents, you know, talking to me about, you know, kind of the path that I was going. And when you think about when, you know, talking to children, a lot of times they're like, hey, you know, you got to talk to this kid. I used to, my parents would say to me, hey, you got to talk to your brothers. And I would. And I would say, hey, look, you know, you should do this, this, and this. But at some point in someone's life, they have to make the decision. So that time when I mentioned I was shot at, I was like 14. When I was 15 is when I started to really look at my life and say, man, I see these other kids that I went to high school with, and they're starting to like talk about this thing called college. Like I didn't even consider college. It wasn't even like an option for me. And
same here.
Right. And yeah. And then I was like, well, what else am I going to do? I'm a big dude. And I was like, well, I could just, you know, manual labor. I could dig ditches or I could do whatever. And I just, that didn't interest me. And so then I started to really say to myself, like, okay, what am I going to do with my life at 15? But that's really a critical moment, I think, in a lot of kids' lives where you have to make that decision yourself. So I just decided, you know, I got to do something here. Like, I got to turn my grades around. I was a great athlete. I played football, baseball, basketball. I wasn't good at basketball. And I had coaches and teachers basically say, look, if you want to continue to play these sports, you have to improve your grades. You have to do well. And you know, the coaches and teachers were the ones that really kind of drove me. You know, my parents did too, but it was the consequences that the teachers and coaches gave me. Like, if you don't show up to class, I'm going to fail you. And then if you fail, you're going to be off the team. So I was lucky to be able to recognize the consequences of my decisions, because the type of kids that grew up in my neighborhood, they just say, fuck it. Like, all right, cool. I'm not going to class. Whatever. Go ahead and do whatever it is you need to do. And I saw that happen all the time. And then that's just a kind of just the wrong way to think. And for whatever reason, I decided that I was going to, you know, do the right thing. By the way, I didn't always do the right thing. I still had a long way to go. I mean, I got arrested in college, you know. So I started to make that shift in my life right around that age, around 15. And, you know, it's always kind of a bit of a work in progress. You know, this whole topic of happiness now, as we sit here today in, you know, in 2021, and mental health, right? Like, it seems to be like the in thing. You know, I wrote about it in my first book, Ask More, Get More, 7 years ago, talking about, you know, meditation and happiness and really how important that is. And it's always been something, again, I own a clothing line called Wicked Happy, because happiness, it's two things. If you don't have your health and happiness, like, what else do you have? And so as I get older, I realize that those are really the most important things, you know, health, happiness. You know, you can list a couple other things in there, but for me, that's kind of what I'm working towards. And I know, you know, I'm, you know, kind of going on and on here, but happiness, that people don't understand, like, we're not designed to be happy. Like, what do you mean? Like our reptilian brain is not designed to be happy. We're designed to actually be nervous. We're designed to be able to, like, you know, literally, like, look over our shoulder, because it's a survival instinct. Happiness is not technically something that it's just naturally there. I mean, look, you have hormones that impact your brain that help with happiness, but you need to work towards happiness. And once I realized that, like, oh, I'm not just going to be happy. Like, you know, when you wake up in a bad mood, there's a reason why that happens. And when you wake up in a good mood, there's also a reason why that happens. But 9 times out of 10, when you're waking up in those moods, it's because of the way you think and the way you thought before you went to bed.
Exactly. I'm so glad to hear you say that, because a lot of people don't realize that. And there's so often we cause our own unhappiness. You know, my journey began 30 years ago, a little over 30 years ago, when I was addicted to cocaine.
Oh.
Back in the late 80s. Yep. And then it was the early 90s, and I actually didn't drink alcohol for 20 years. And now I, after many years of therapy and everything, it was mainly because I didn't really have an issue with the alcohol. It was the cocaine. Mm-hmm. And they're totally on different spectrums. So I do have a glass of wine here and there now, but I went to Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many years, and it's in my head, you know? So it's like, I know, but that was the catalyst for me to realize that happiness is a choice, number one, but it's something that you have to work on every single day. And all the little tools that I use, none of them are mastered, right? It's a practice. You have to practice.
It's a practice. It's something you work towards, you know. I said this before on podcasts and on the programs, or, you know, and it's kind of an absurd thing to say. I'll just say it though, but again, just know the way I grew up. So I live in a private neighborhood. A 6,000 square foot house in the town that I grew up in. And it's like a big giant exclamation point of, like, hey, I made it, but not really. You know, I still have a massive mortgage. And in my bedroom, above the fireplace in my bedroom, again, this sounds so pretentious, but there's a point to it. There is a painting by an artist. His name is Romero Brito. His art makes me happy, right? But the art itself, actually, it's an original painting of his, of the word happy. And
wow.
When I wake up in the morning, it's one of the first things that I see. And, you know, sometimes I don't look at it and you know, I honestly haven't really kind of gauged it, like, oh, how's my day going, but, you know, versus me looking at it. But I made a point of putting it in my bedroom. I could have put it anywhere else, but it's like kind of the first thing that I see. I also have a little statue of it, or it's not a statue, I guess. I don't even know what you would even call it, some sort of ceramic thing, but basically a version of it. It says the word happy. And then when you walk out of my bedroom to the left-hand side, there is, and I made it myself, essentially a poster. You can do this on some of these websites. It just says the words, choose happiness. And, you know, these are the things, like you're talking about, you know, these, the whole mindset like shift that people that people start to work towards, and when they start to embrace things like affirmations or working towards, like you said, happiness and understanding that you need it is a work in progress. You're never going to master it. You're never always going to be happy, but you can work towards it, and it does work, and it is work. And you know, look, there are days when, you know, especially in the winter, like here in New England, you know, where people get seasonal affective disorder, and there's certain things that, you know, you can do to that. But I also think it's important to be aware, like to have self-awareness, like, man, if there's been multiple days in a row and I'm not feeling mentally good, and you maybe have to say to yourself, why is that? Is it what I ate? Is it, you know, what I'm doing? Is it who I'm with? Is it what, you know, is it literally my environment? Is it what I'm breathing? Is it what I'm drinking? And a lot of times it's, you know, you can find the answers by just asking yourself those questions.
Absolutely. And, you know, here's the thing. I tell this in my book and on my program, you know, I am so flawed. It's not even funny. I mean, I still lose my temper. I get irritated. But the difference is when you've been working on it for so many years and you know, you can get back to that place of peace and happiness a lot quicker. And that's why it's a work in progress. And you can't beat yourself up over it, because we are human and we're perfectly imperfect.
Yeah, it is. And it's like, you know, there's the classic thing like within the diet industry, right? It's why the diet industry is so massive, is because what happens is, and again, you talked about, you know, AA, but NA and AA are similar, just you talk about narcotics versus, you know, alcohol. You're going to fall off the wagon. You know, it's a part of the process. But what happens is, especially in the diet industry, when people fall off the wagon, they just give up. It happens a lot with addiction too, right? They just come up and they go back to it. But you have to understand that that's a part of the process. So you're going to do things that are going to have a detrimental effect on your own happiness. It's just like you said, it's just we're imperfect beings. And so you'll drink like maybe you shouldn't have, or you'll consume sugar, which is a huge thing that people don't realize. You get that instant kind of dopamine rush, and then you crash. That's the crash, and that's the mental part of the crash. But it doesn't mean you should give up. Right. So like, especially with the diets, like I tell people that I'm keto. Like I was keto, like consistently for like 2 years, and I was in great shape and I felt great. I always, you know, I'm kind of keto now, you know, I constantly screw up. I'm trying to work towards it and trying to maybe just get into a better routine and a better habit. But right now, as I sit here today in my life, that's one big thing for me. Like I'm not where I need to be. I just know that keto works for me. Tried a vegetarian diet once that didn't work for me. I just tried eating, you know, less, and that didn't necessarily work for me, but I just found that keto works for me. And, you know, I had Dave Asprey on of the Bulletproof Diet and on my podcast. And, you know, he said, look, Mike, you know, don't pick one particular thing and let it define you. Like, you know, the Bulletproof Diet isn't necessarily a keto diet, but it's a high fat diet with certain fats that are good for you. But look, if you want to have a piece of fruit, which he kind of says fruit is dessert, then fine, go for it. Just know that what you're doing is going to, you know, have an impact on your body one way or the other. So my point of all this stuff is like when you're working towards happiness or you're working towards whatever, if you fail or if you make a mistake, it doesn't mean you should give up. You just get right back on it, right?
Exactly. So what are some of the things that you do when you find, you know, wake up, you're having a good day, and all of a sudden something happens? What do you do to press that reset button?
It's hard. I mean, it's really hard. You know, I listen to people all the time and they give advice, and I just wonder like how real it is. You know, like I'm honest, like, you know what? Like I get the shit kicked out of me every day in business, and like you're like, well, wait a minute, like what's going on here? Are you doing something wrong? No, it's just, that's just the life of an entrepreneur. It's a sexy thing to talk about now. You know, when my grandfather was an entrepreneur, it was looked at as he was a dreamer, or he was just sometimes even like a loser because the business wouldn't work. But, you know, to answer your question is like, it's hard. I mean, if you put together a series of habits or daily things that you do consistently, that's one of the best things that you can do. So like what I like to do first thing in the morning is, again, I look at the word happy. I remind myself of that. And it's again, it's hard to do. We're like, well, I'm just waking up. I'm tired. Do I really want to remind myself of three things that I'm grateful for? That's another thing that I do. And sometimes
but that's a huge way to make a shift.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's really basic stuff, you know? So that's one big thing that I do. I remind myself of three things that I'm grateful for every day. I spend about 3 minutes. I'm also a practitioner of transcendental meditation. TM changed my life, absolutely changed my life. And I've been screaming from the rooftops about it for years. I learned about TM from Howard Stern and what it did first for his mother, who was suffering severe depression, and she was suicidal. And then, you know, he talked about what it did for him. And then I researched TM, and you look at all the other celebrities and huge influential people all over the world who practice TM, and the science behind TM is what really got me. You see, I sell, you know, nutritional products and health and wellness products in addition to my books. And so science is key for us, right? I'm a lawyer by trade, so we got to make sure that what we're saying, we can in fact substantiate. And when you, so I understand how to read the medical science. And when I saw the science behind TM in particular, and then also just as well as just, you know, traditional kind of mindfulness meditation, TM is just far and away has been studied a lot more and has a lot more, you know, proven results. So I'm like, that's it. That's what I'm going for. So I suffered a massive panic attack on a Friday, like 8 years ago. And I had moved out, I was separated, and we, you know, were getting divorced, and my daughter was with me. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and she happened to wake up as well. So she saw like something was going on, but she couldn't quite tell. I knew what was happening to me, but I thought I was going to have to go to the hospital. Like, it was that bad. I didn't go to the hospital. That was a Friday. And then that following Monday, I just went to the local TM center here in my hometown and learned it and I never looked back. Not to say that I haven't had close to incidences like that. And by the way, I just woke up in the middle of the night and it just happened. It wasn't like all of a sudden I had like something, like someone broke into my house.
It wasn't like a trigger.
Yeah, there was no trigger. I just woke up and that's what I woke up to. And it's scary. But a lot of times too, like especially with even like with addiction, and you hear there's usually one thing that happens to somebody where they go, that's it. All right, this enough is enough. And it happens a lot with addiction. And a lot of times people don't even know why it even happens. Like in The Power of Habit, I don't know if you've read that book where they talk a lot about addiction in that book. And how people, they just, you know, you hear about people hitting rock bottom or whatever. And for me, that's probably what it was. It was probably having some sort of crisis that I just was maybe, which there was a crisis. I was moved out. I was
married. Going through a divorce. I mean, divorce is one of the most stressful things that you can go through.
Yeah, exactly. So TM has really been the big thing. Every day reminding yourself of three things you're grateful for. And again, just really kind of being self-aware. That's really it for me. Like, again, like what's going on? Like, why is this happening? You know, is there a way to change the way you're doing things? You know, a lot of people, you know, the definition of insanity, right? You know, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result.
Yep.
We do it all the time. I do it. We all do it.
Oh, yeah. We all do it. So back to the TM, for those of people who aren't familiar with that, can you talk a little bit more about that type of meditation?
Yeah, I mean, I'm by no means an expert, but transcendental meditation is something that, you know, came from the Maharishi, how it became popular here in the United States was really the Beatles. They brought it over. They went over there. They learned it from him. You know, it's been around for, I don't know, thousands of years, I think, really. But it was really what made it popular was in the 60s here in the States. It was kind of seems like this hippie-ish thing. And when I first learned about it, there's a great book called Transcendence. It's the name of the book. Rosenthal, I think, is the author. I would recommend it to anybody to just read and just learn about, you know, kind of like what TM does. But really, the kind of the basics of TM is that, you know, you take it's a week long course. And then once you learn it, that's it. You know, you're good to go. You can go to any TM center in the world if you want to like do like a what they call a reset and just maybe learn a little bit more about it. But really what happens is you're given a mantra. And the mantra is it's a nonverbal kind of sound, really, that you can't spell or anything like that. And basically what you're doing is when you close your eyes and start your practice, which is supposed to be 20 minutes twice a day, which, by the way, I don't do 20 minutes twice a day. I should, but I just don't. And again, I'm just being honest with you. And you're just repeating that mantra over and over again in your head. And there's different ways to do it. But, you know, what I learned, what you learn in TM is like, you're going to have these thoughts that are going to come into your head. You're going to be restless. You're going to want to open your eyes. You're going to want to get up. You're going to be itchy. You're going to notice things. You're going to have all these things that you're going to want to act on. And it's just a part of the brain kind of just settling down. But as you continue to do it over and over again, like we talked about earlier, like the habits, once it becomes a habit, it just becomes easier and then it becomes better. And when I was first learning about TM, the teacher would ask you, how you felt, it's like feedback. And the only way to describe it for me was like blissful nothingness is what I would say. Like you talk about happiness. Like, again, I was going through some serious stuff when I first learned it. And I started to feel happy again. It took time, especially when you have like a real hardcore panic attack like I had. Like, it lingers for weeks. Like, it doesn't, like that instant crisis of like, oh my God, I think I'm going to die, that goes away, but it lingers for weeks. And so, TM just kind of helped get me through it. And by the way, the other thing too is that I went to my doctor. I'm a big dude. I'm a type A personality, a football player in college. I own big businesses. I've done a lot of things. I've three-time Wall Street. I feel like I'm just this kind of like go, go, go type guy. But I knew that something was wrong. And when I went to my doctor, he said, Mike, a lot of people in your position, they just don't deal with it. And how do they deal with it? Exactly. Kind of, they deal with it by drugs and alcohol, and you self-medicate and it just spirals out of control. And he said, look, we can go about this with some pharmaceuticals. I'm really kind of anti that stuff, but I was in so much pain, like physical and mental pain. And he said, look, here's a couple different drugs that you can take, like antidepressant type drugs and anxiety meds, that you don't have to be on forever. It's something to kind of get you through that crisis. And again, I'm really anti drug. I just always have been, because I just, you hear about the side effects and everything later on in life.
Exactly.
But to get you through those kind of moments, there's nothing wrong with it. And again, now when we're talking about mental health here, in 2021, and everybody, and you see commercials for it on TV and you see apps like Calm, and everyone's like, it's like, oh, okay, we can talk about it now. I was talking about this stuff, and not to say that I'm like some sort of soothsayer or something. I was talking about this 7 years ago before it was the cool thing to talk about.
Yeah. Well, now it's an emergency. Like, we have to talk about
it's
this.
It's an emergency now for us, but it's also an emergency for you. So like, I just urge people, like, if you're depressed, if you're anxious, there's nothing wrong with going to your doctor and asking for help. Some doctors are, they're going to just overprescribe, and, maybe you want to consider that and understand that. But if you need that kind of like that help, now a lot of these, kind of depression type drugs, they take time actually to get into your system. And so it's not going to be an immediate thing as well. But I also looked at like, what am I eating? Am I drinking too much coffee? Another thing, I was playing the game Call of Duty. I had surgery on my knee, so that during that time. So I was kind of cooped up in my house. I was going through a divorce. I was playing Call of Duty like all day
long. Oh my gosh.
Running a business. And it's just like, it just all hit me. So again, I just urge people to seek, the medical advice and just talk to somebody. And then we can talk about therapy too, because I think that's important as well. You'd mention therapy, yeah.
For sure. I mean, I've dealt with my son. With major anxiety issues. And it's a horrible thing to hear your teenage boy, he's now 20 years old, but to hear him every single morning throwing up and nothing would work, So he's, he does a combination of CBD and some other things that help, that I'm not going to say, that help him to stay calm. And I've had discussions with his father, who, we've been divorced for quite a while. And I'm like, you haven't been here. My ex-husband's in prison.
Oh, geez.
By the way. Yeah, he was out drinking one night, hit a motorcycle and killed two people.
Oh, geez.
And that was back in 2013. So I'm like, you haven't been here. Like, you haven't been around your son to hear him and go through this every single day. But yeah, I mean, and he's not, my son's just not ready for therapy. And I know for myself, because I didn't go to therapy for years. You have to be ready and willing. It's just like giving up alcohol, giving up drugs, going to therapy, whatever. If you're not ready, you're not going to do it.
Right. I mean, it's like what we talked about earlier, you know, with the 15-year-old self, like, you know, you just have to want it and have to do it, you know, and maybe the anxiety isn't as bad as you think right now. When it gets really bad, when you're crippled and you can't even move and like you feel like you're going to die and you feel like you're having a heart attack, then, you know, maybe it's there. Like, look, when I was in law school, like you had like these mini panic attacks all the time because you just don't want to get called.
Of course you did.
You know, and those are just part of the process. But you know, when you have like the physical, like when it manifests itself physically, like, you know, a lot of times people, they'll break out in hives or what have you. Like when it starts to actually manifest itself physically like that, like what's happening with your son or like with throwing up, that's one of them. But, you know, sometimes you just, it's like with drugs and alcohol, you know, people just have to hit rock bottom before they realize, all right, it's enough is enough. And you can do something about it. That's the thing too. It's like, you know, when you're, I don't know that I've ever really necessarily been depressed, but I've probably had bouts of like temporary depression or like, you know, seasonal affective disorder. And especially with the anxiety, you just feel like it's never going to end. And that's the scariest part about it, right? And so when you talk about CBD, like I own a CBD line and I never put anything cannabis related in my body ever. I never smoked a cigarette, never done any drugs. In 2016, I launched a CBD product way before anyone was really talking about it. And I tried it for the first time and I was like, wow, okay, cool. Like I slept great. I didn't have any pain in my, I tore my hamstring. I didn't have any pain in the morning like I usually did. And then just a couple of years ago, let's see, I'll be 44. And then THC became legal here. I am like, not only am I anti prescription drugs, but I'm like anti drug altogether. Like, you know, just because again, you heard my history. Heroin, mm-hmm. my stepfather, and cocaine, yep. my father, and my brother's was a fucking drug dealer. Like, so I've never, but at 44, and I was trying CBD, and I actually got my ex-wife actually suffers with rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and osteoarthritis, so she's in really bad shape. And I was,
oh my gosh,
look, you know, I'm like, you know, have you considered cannabis? You know, and you know, so she was kind of like, I don't know, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, look, tell you what, I'll go to the local dispensary. I'd never been to a dispensary before. And I'm like, I'll go and I'll just get it for you and just, you know, see what happens, you know? And what happened was, is I ended up trying it myself. I was like, fuck it. I'm 44. Like what's the worst that's going to happen? And my father, who's been smoking pot his whole life, and my brothers have been smoking pot since they were like kids, you know, as you get it, when you're young, and your mind is like still developing, and the science proves this. When you're smoking pot, you're putting THC in your body. There is 100% proven science that it has a detrimental effect on your neurology and also on your brain matter itself. Right.
Right. Right.
And by the way, it's permanent. That's the thing that people don't understand. Right. And so as you're growing, right, when you get older and you're fully developed, you can also have a detrimental impact in your brain. It's called neuroplasticity. Right. And so, but at the same time, you're not going to have such a negative impact on your brain matter and the actual connectivity and the neurons in your brain when you're older as if you were when you're 14 years old. So when you hear about these kids are doing drugs at a very young age, and you know, they always say once a drug addict, always a drug addict. Like that's true. Like if you look at a brain scan for people, like that's true. Here's the cool part though, is that even at the young age, but when you're older and it happens, you can actually reverse it. And that, people are like, well, it doesn't make sense. TM is one of the ways to do it. Meditation is one of the ways to do it. It's proven science. If you look at the brain of a drug addict and you look at the brain of somebody who's recovered, right? The drug addict, if you look at the brain matter, it literally looks like a mountain range, like the Rockies. It peaks, it dips. It looks like there's pieces of the brain actually taken away. And then you look at a healthy brain and it's smooth and it's rounded. And the coolest part about neuroplasticity is that you can actually change it if you work towards it. By the way, at any age, you know, so the problem though is that when you're developing, is you can have that long-term permanent where you just can't reverse it. When you're older, right, after your brain has already developed, again, you can change it both ways. It can be negative and it can be positive. The coolest thing is that you can change it. So when we think about also like our memory and we think about things like Alzheimer's disease and things like this and dementia and also just, you know, being just forgetting things. It doesn't have to be that way. It really doesn't. And things like TM actually can really help change your brain matter, change the way that your neurons fire. And then when you come out of a meditation session, it's crazy. Like what happens, like your brain is just like, it's just like working, but not like working in a restless way. It's like, oh my God, like I can do all these things. And that's like kind of like just the powerful part of meditation. We barely know anything about our brains, but we know now just through CAT scans that you can look at the science. You can look at the brain before meditation, during meditation, and after meditation. Again, I just implore, it's tm.org. You can just see the science there. It's wild, you know, what you can do.
So I took a meditation course back in 2007. Yeah, it was 2007. And a friend of mine introduced me to it. And it's with Stephen Sadler of the Self-Awareness Institute. He's out in Laguna Beach and he has trained like tens of thousands of people. The form of the meditation is escaping me right now. But what I remember, and I don't do it that often anymore, but I went to some of his meditation retreats and we would sit for 4 hours at a time. And what his does is the part of your brain, the thalamus, that type of, and I don't know if TM is the same way, but when you get into the meditation and you're thriving in it, let's say, there's a part of your brain, it's right at the crown, and it starts numbing. There's like a numbing sensation that is like the greatest high I have ever experienced in my life. And I know with the thalamus, that's the part of the brain that we don't know a lot about and the part of the brain you can improve. So is that what the science is about?
Well, yeah. I mean, with TM? It's your entire brain. Your entire brain can, in fact, change. And again, right. The science behind it is called neuroplasticity. And it just shows that when you do things like TM or other forms of meditation, you can literally rewire your brain. Like it actually can happen. The neurons that weren't firing before now can fire.
Right.
And you know, it just doesn't seem real for people, especially people who are down and out or people who have just experienced loss and they are like clinically depressed or they feel like, you know, they're giving up. You know, to find something like meditation, yoga is, you know, is another great one too. Like yoga and the practicing of yoga, which I did for a long time too, that in itself is also kind of like a form. Look, prayer is a form of meditation. People don't realize, right. when you go to church, and when you're singing in church and everyone's singing in unison, or when you're praying, it's very similar to the same type of brain activity that happens with meditation. So as far as I'm concerned, when you're praying, you're meditating. So whatever works for you, you know, that's why church,
exactly.
Why people, I mean, people like church because they have the fear of God. I mean, that's really big. I mean, we talk a lot about religion if we want, but that's really it. But the other part though is that when you're praying, you're meditating. Plain and simple. <That's what it is. laughs>
I remember years ago when I had done the meditation course and I was doing a lot of workshops and whatnot, and I got certified as a life coach in the like 2004. But I sent out just a newsletter, and people subscribed to my newsletter. And one of my neighbors who was born again Christian, she sent me the most scathing email about meditation and how it's just unchristian like and da 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 da. And I thought, well, don't you know that that's what Jesus did in the Bible, right? He sat in meditation for how many days and nights, right. I forget, you know. But anyway, you're right. It is.
Well, you know, I have an interesting point, too. It's kind of off topic in a way, but too, it's like when you think about like this country right now and the divisiveness of this country, you know, with Trump and not Trump and Biden and all this other stuff, mask, no mask, vax, no vax, like all this other stuff. There's just no reason why someone has to be violently against something and just all this and violently against a particular person because one person believes in one thing or another. Like, so if you're a Trump supporter, like I have good friends. I did not vote for Trump. I'm not a Trump supporter. I am not necessarily even anti-Trump. I think most of the shit he's done is fucking insane. We can go there with that. But my friends that are Trump guys, like just totally like just the types that are posting on Facebook and annoying all their friends or whatever. I worked in D.C. I worked for Richard Neal. He's a Democrat in the House. And so I grew up on things that were just that were really driven by Democrats the way I grew up. Right. You know, so I've been kind of my dad said to me one day, oh, you being a Democrat or Republican, I'm not being one thing or the other. So if you have a particular view that is, you know, opposite of mine, doesn't mean I have to hate you.
Exactly.
I mean, like, it doesn't mean I have to just send you an email. Like, that is such a waste of energy. You know what I mean? Like, look, like, you know, with this whole mask thing and everyone's like, you know, these Facebook doctors and you know, these Facebook experts, which are your friends, and they have no idea what they're talking about because they read an article somewhere and now all of a sudden they're an expert. And those are the people that, you know, would drive me crazy. But I'm like, whatever, dude. Like, you want to fucking say that, you know, wearing a mask is going to, you know, you're going to breathe carbon monoxide or whatever the hell you're going to breathe. Dude, cool, whatever. Like, and if you want to spread misinformation, great. I don't really care. Like, I don't hate you for it. You know what I mean? I disagree. You know what I mean? Like, I don't necessarily agree with you, but I'm not going to hate you for it until it gets to the point where it does get personal. And then if someone like that, you know, like sends an email like that or they send something scathing, fuck it. Just block them. Yep. See you later. I mean, my phone is full of blocked contacts, including from family members, because they're just toxic. And you know.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, the toxicity it has reached a level in this country that is just unprecedented. And, you know, but I really believe it has to come from each individual person. If each individual person could just learn to love themselves and just take a few simple steps every single day, it would change the whole world.
Yeah, just work on yourself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like when you talk like TM again, I'm not like, I'm just, you know, I have no stake in TM.
No, but it works.
Well, yeah.
It's a meditation is the most amazing thing you can do for yourself.
It does work. And that's why, you know, like I've been screaming about it for a long time. When I find something that I know that can help people, like I was screaming about cryptocurrency. Now everyone's, oh, hey, let's buy Bitcoin. I was screaming about it when it was $3,000 and I learned about it when it was $400, you know? So, and I've done some great things in that world. And you know, CBD, you know, I when I learned about CBD, I'm like screaming. Look, and I sell all sorts of supplements like you're talking about. I'm not getting on my Facebook page saying, hey, you should try Androzine or Arthur D, even though I know that they can help people because, you know, if ED wasn't an issue for people, then there wouldn't be tons of drugs out there and other products out there. But I'm not screaming about that stuff because it just like just doesn't seem necessary. But like with TM, I'm like, my God, I put 25 employees through it. I put my parents through it. CBD, same thing. I'm like, you got to try this stuff, whatever. Cryptocurrency, when I learned about the benefits of not making money with cryptocurrency, but really what it meant, like the essence of cryptocurrency and the decentralization aspect of it and the democratization side of it. I was like, this is amazing. Like for those of you who feel like you're left behind, you feel like you can't get involved, you can buy $1. Like right now you can buy $1 worth of Bitcoin. So I would scream about it. And then people would, you know, attack me. Oh my God, blah, blah, blah. You should, you know, you be careful and you're giving, you know, financial advice and you're a lawyer. I'm like, no, I'm not doing any of that stuff. I'm just telling you what I've learned and I'm sharing it with you. If you don't like it, you don't need to attack me, unfollow me, unfriend me, whatever. I'm just trying to share with people the things that I found have worked for me. And not only have they worked for me, I just know that they work for other people. And so the whole point of it, what we're saying is like, there's just no reason. It's just not necessary. It's just a negative activity. It's a total time suck. It's toxic to you to even care about somebody so much because they're, you know, anti-mask or anti-Trump, whatever. Even if like, let's say you lost somebody to COVID that maybe could have been, a lot of stuff could have been avoided, but let's say you lost somebody to COVID and you got some guy out there on your Facebook feed who's just like saying that it's fake. It's not real, blah, blah, blah. All right, well, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, fucking who cares?
You can unfollow them. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
I unfollow a lot of people. I generally don't always block them unless it gets to the point where it's, but I unfollow people because I can't see that negativity all the time.
Right.
If you don't have anything positive to say, I don't want to read about it. I don't want to hear about it. It just brings you down.
Yeah. I mean, it brings up another good point too. Like, you know, just being able to do that and be able to make that decision, you know, of like, I'm going to unfollow people. I'm going to unfriend people. I'm going to block people. And a lot of times when you talk about one's own happiness, when you really like look at it, you know, a lot of times one's own happiness is a direct reflection of their own family members, and they're the ones that are bringing you down. And it's really hard, especially if you're a young person. Like, how do you get away from that? Like, what do you like? You know, there are things you can do, especially like, you know, now in this world we're living in. You know, you can get on YouTube and watch things that motivate you. You know, I watch videos a lot that, you know, that motivate me. So there are ways to kind of get to cut these people out of your life. You know, my family members that I had mentioned, you know, you can love them, but you don't have to like them. It's a big difference.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And so you can cut them out of your life. Like I like one of my brothers is cut out of my life. Like if I never talk to him again, people may get mad at me for saying this. I'm good. I'm cool with that. because he is a toxic individual that I don't want to be a part of. And we've gone around it millions of, but too many times. I'm done. Like, that's it. And people, too many people are afraid to do that for whatever reason, because they feel as like that, you know, they say, things like, what's the saying? Like, family's everything. Well, kind of,
kind of,
because here's the thing. The definition of family has changed, when you think about a wolf. This is really interesting, right? So and people know this. Like, you've heard of, like, people, like, literally, like, humans being raised by wolves. I don't know if that's real or not. But wolves actually will take in other animals and raise them as if they're their own. And they and those animals, like, there's been studies that show that deer, which wolves will eat, have been raised by packs of wolves. And they grow, and a deer grows up with the packs of wolves and lives his entire life basically as if he's a wolf and doesn't get eaten by any of the other wolves. And so the question becomes: is that deer a part of the wolf pack? Is that deer a part of the wolf's family? Well, biologically, no, but it really is. And so, when you think about your family, it doesn't have to be your bloodline. It can be other people. Like, I have friends, male, female, whatever. And like, I just was talking to somebody. I say, hey, man, I love you. And I think of them as like my family. Like in the traditional definition of it, these are the people that they uplift me. They motivate me. Like, when they're feeling down, like they can lean on me and I can lean on them. And a lot of times your family members, you can't. Like, the reason why I'm not married anymore with my ex-wife, she's not a bad person. I'm not a bad person, but we just couldn't communicate with each other. It takes two to tango. And what I realized is that I wasn't able to talk to her about some of the things that were going on in my business life and she wasn't able to talk to me about some of the things that she was feeling, and ultimately that just led to the demise of our marriage, because we weren't able to communicate with each other. So if you want to communicate with people, a lot of times, again, it's your family members, and you can't, well, find other people that you can and consider them your family.
Absolutely. I know. I mean, I'm fortunate that I have a really good siblings and everything. Are they always there for me? No. And that's okay. I rely on my girlfriends more than anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, so my brother, he had a minor surgery procedure last week, and I had to pick him up, and I haven't seen him in over a year because of COVID. And but he couldn't drive home because he had anesthesia. So we were both masked up and everything. And he's now 60 years old. And he's like, yeah, I haven't had a drink in 8 months. And I'm like, that's incredible. Right. Cause I just, he now has, he's in a program, he was able to get on disability, he has his own apartment, things are good. I used to send him $50 every 2 weeks just to pay for his cigarettes, because nobody else would help him in the family. But he said the last time he drank, he had one beer and his body just, he was throwing up violently and his body just rejected it. He just physically can't drink anymore. And I'm like, you know what? That's a godsend.
Right.
Good. That's great.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's 60 years old. He needs to stop drinking. He would be a binge drinker. So he would drink for like 4 days nonstop. And then he would quit for like, 45, 60 days. And then he would do it again. And it was just this binging, which is,
Yeah. For me, I just would think about, I would talk to myself and say, man, just remember how you feel right now. And just, and the next time you want to drink for me, like right now, like I feel, like I said earlier, it's like my addiction is actually food or sugar. So, I'll go throughout the entire day, I'll eat healthy or I'll eat keto or whatever. And then late at night, that's my thing. And sugar, again, research shows, like, this is a crazy statement as well, but science shows it. It's just not me saying this, that sugar is as addictive as heroin.
It's lethal to our bodies as well. It's lethal
to our bodies. And for me, like, that's my thing right now, So it's like, but, at the same time, as humans, and again, the way our brains work, like, tackling a bunch of different things at once just doesn't work. So, like, work on, like, right now, my business is shifting. We're pivoting. We're doing all these things. It's like, all right, you know what, man? I'm not drinking. I'm dealing with some business stuff. I'm working on some pivots that we're doing. It's very stressful, blah, blah.
Go
blah,
easy blah. On yourself.
Yeah. You're just like, all right, I'm going to have some Girl Scout cookies because they're there, And then, eventually they'll be gone.
And that's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. And then you just work towards it. When it becomes a chronic thing, that's that becomes a problem. But people don't understand, like, food is an addiction as well.
Oh, huge. But like they say, progress, not perfection.
That's it. Yeah, you're never going to be perfect. But I mean, chasing perfection is not a bad thing. Chase it, you just knowing that you're never going to get there, but you come anywhere close, you're good.
You know, a friend of mine taught me, she calls it the perfect game, just deem everything perfect. So however your day shows up, it's perfect.
Yeah.
Right? It's perfect. Yeah. But then I heard another speaker say, don't strive for perfection, strive for excellence. So I've been trying to shift that in my mind. I'm striving for excellence because things will never be perfect, but I can strive for that excellence.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of just what I said too. It's like, you know, chase perfection, knowing you're not going to get there. Come close, right. You're going to be okay. So yeah, I mean, and in your definition of excellence, or it's like the definition of success too. People, oh, what's the definition of success? Well, it's different for everybody, you know. So, you know, whatever your I always tell people the definition of success is whatever it is you want it to be. Not what I want it to be. It's what you want it to be. You have to decide what you want is considered successful. And if that's monetary stuff, if that's material things, all right, cool. Like that's your definition of it, you know? Again, it's just how you define things.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me about what else is going on. I know, do you have any new books coming out? And do you want to mention some of the books?
You know, that you've read? What else is going on? Do you really want to know? yeah, I don't know. You know, so, I mean, you know, it's funny. We met on Clubhouse, right? Is this how this whole thing happened?
No. I posted on that site on Facebook for marketing authors.
Yeah, cool.
And I just posted, hey, I'm looking for people to be on my podcast.
That's what it was. Yeah. So, you know, I've written a bunch of books, right? Free Wall Street Journal, USA Today bestsellers. And I wrote a children's book and I wrote a couple others that I just kind of self-published that I didn't put up anywhere. And Clubhouse we're talking about, I've been talking about it a lot. It's a great networking app and it's an audio only. It's amazing if you're not on it.
Are there any YouTube videos to explain that? Because I'm on there and I don't know what to do.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm sure there are. But so what I realized on Clubhouse is that there are a lot of authors. There are a lot of people who are like considering writing a book. Everyone talks about wanting to write a book. You said that you wrote a book. But the challenge for most authors, what they don't understand is that, you know, writing the book is half the process. The other half is the marketing part. And most authors, like through and through authors, they don't want to market. They don't want to sell. And they have a real aversion to it. And the problem with that is their book isn't just going to sell itself. So I wrote a book called Bestseller Secrets, and it's exactly what I've done over the years, not only for myself, but others. And I give it away for free. It's 27,000 words. It's not like this downloadable thing. It's a few pages. It's just a few pages. It's literally everything I've done. It's not going to win me any literary awards, but it's more of a tactical guide for authors on what to do. And I'm really excited about it because when you talk about happiness and you talk about your purpose and passion, to be able to help other authors, I've spent literally millions of dollars of my own money and 7 years trying to figure this whole thing out. And I put it all together in this book. And I'm excited about it because, you know, it does help people. So if people wanted it, you can go to bestsellersecretsbook.com. And again, it's bestsellersecretsbook.com because there's another book out there called Bestseller. And I gave it away for free. And if you're an author and you know, you want to learn what I've done to not only do it for myself, but for other authors, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and Amazon, even chasing the New York Times, I show people how to do it. And, you know, we didn't talk a lot about pain, but, you know, it's a painful experience when you do this thing and you put together this project and you release it and nobody cares, because that's really just that's just the reality of it. Nobody cares about your book. Nobody cares about my book. It just is what it is. How do people care about it? Well, when it gets put in front of them and they learn about it and when it's successful. So if your book is a bona fide, legitimate, like bestseller, when I say bestseller, I'm talking number one,
right?
Success begets success. And people are like, oh, cool. Like, all right, it's number one. I'll be interested in that. Number one doesn't necessarily mean it's a great book either, but it's more likely to get put in front of somebody and it's more likely to get picked up and distributed more if it's in that stuff. So that's what I got going on right now. I'm excited about it. And so to answer your question, that's it. I think that's what I got.
That's awesome. Well, Michael, it was a pleasure speaking with you. I love all the stories that you shared and I love your passion.
Cool.
It's really infectious.
Well, I'm glad we connected and make sure we connect on Clubhouse, by the way.
I will definitely. I've had a lot going on lately. And as I said, I do have a full-time job. So sometimes it's hard, but I need to like look into the Clubhouse thing because I'm on there and I'm not quite sure what it is.
I guess it will end with it. Like if you're not on, like, I don't know when this is necessarily going to air or whatever, but if you're not in Clubhouse, like cryptocurrency is talking about, like meditation, like CBD. There are certain things that I've seen in my life that are truly life-changing, and Clubhouse is one of them. The ability to connect with people and to develop relationships quickly on Clubhouse is remarkable. There are people that you've never even heard of. I've developed friendships with people that I've never even heard of, don't know who they are. Now I know who they are. Now they know who I am. And we're not only doing business together, but we've become friends. And so one of the greatest ways, you know, people say it's your network is in fact your net worth. That's a true thing. And so, you know, right now, you know, if you're trying to connect with people that are playing on a different level than you, it's really hard to do that. What do? You go to a trade show, you go to a conference or whatever. Maybe you get on Facebook, Instagram, you're sending messages. There's just a lot of noise out there. Clubhouse is an audio only 24 hours a day live app where you can connect with people, talk to people, learn from people. And I'm screaming about it because it's already changed my life. And I think it can change a lot of people's lives. I don't know if it's always going to be like that, but right now, as I'm talking to you, it's remarkable. It's addictive, but it's also like whatever it is. You want to learn about meditation, you want to learn about business, you want to learn about real estate, you want to talk about dogs, whatever it is, whatever you're interested in, it's there, and experts are there as well. And some of the most famous, look, Mark Zuckerberg just popped on it. Like Elon Musk just jumped in. Like all this, the biggest people in the world are getting involved in it because they see the potential in it. So that's my little promotion for Clubhouse. And again, I have nothing to do with it other than the fact that I'm just on it.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And I look forward to learning more about some of the things that you have going on. I'm definitely going to check out your bestseller, secretsbook.com.
Awesome. All right.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right.
Well, thanks.
Take care, Michael.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. So I really love Michael's no-nonsense approach to everything. It was great. He's very entertaining. Just straight shooter, tells it like it is. That was awesome. So once again, you can learn more about Michael Alden on his website, which is michaelalden.net. Please visit my website at sandyscarlotta.com. My book, Happiness Solved, Climbing 100 Steps, is available on barnesandnoble.com and amazon.com. And please follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Coach Sandy Scarlotta. Thank you for listening today. And I hope that you and your family stay healthy and safe, and that your life is filled with joy, peace, and happiness.